Okay, good morning. Bio 241, and it is April 30th, and we're going to finish up the cardiovascular chapter today. So I tell you what, anybody have any questions over the first part of the cardiovascular chapter? I would guess you probably have lots, but maybe you don't know what to ask right at the moment. All right, so I think after today's lecture, a lot of the stuff we were talking about will be a lot more clear. So that's good news. So at the end of lecture, make sure you ask me some questions. All right, so here is the sign-in sheet. Sign-in sheet for today. Thank you so much. All right, did we get done talking about all these hormones last time that regulate blood pressure that I have on the screen right now? Did we cover all those? Did we cover the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism? I believe we did. And the atrial natriuretic hormone mechanism. I believe we did. Oh, there's nothing on the screen. Okay. Okay. Now there's something, and I've got the cursor. Fantastic. Yeah, this is what I wanted to show you. Okay, so what are the three hormonal mechanisms that help regulate blood pressure? Or the three hormones? Yeah, you got antidiuretic hormone, aldosterone, and atrial natriuretic hormone. Which ones of these two are antagonistic to each other? ANP and aldosterone, they're antagonistic. But also, what else? ANP and antidiuretic hormone have opposite actions in the body, okay, in terms of regulating blood pressure. So that means that ADH and aldosterone are synergistic to each other. So probably just don't memorize that, but go ahead and look back at that mechanism and make sure that you confirm my impressions are correct. All right, because you might have to deal with that information somehow. All right, so these hormones basically work by increasing or decreasing urine output, which increases or decreases blood volume. And when blood volume increases, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. A couple of different ways that you should think about it. When you have a tire that's low on pressure, what do? Put air in or take air out? You put air in. Same thing for your body. If your blood pressure is low, your body puts fluid volume into your cardiovascular system that increases blood pressure. But the other mechanism is just as sweet. When you increase blood volume, you have increased venous return to the heart. And as more blood returns to the heart, what happens to the heart during diastole? What happens? It fills with blood, and as more blood is returning to the heart, it stretches more. And so what happens to contractility of the heart as it stretches more? It goes up. Contractility goes up because, and you should know the name of that law that describes that, and that's the Frank-Starling law of the heart. So stroke volume increases, and then the cardiac output increases, and then blood pressure increases as a result of that. Okay. So those are the two ways you should think about it. So ADH, aldosterone, and atrial natriuretic hormone all work through those mechanisms, although some in the reverse direction. All right, so you sure we went over this diagram? Great. The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Okay, so I think we got to about right here last time. And I want to talk about factors that can affect blood flow. All right, so vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue or an organ. And how can you regulate vascular resistance? What determines vascular resistance? And in lab, you guys work with Poiseuille's equation as a hint. Poiseuille's equation. Okay, it is what determines the resistance to flow in any kind of tube? Viscosity, for instance, of the blood. If the viscosity goes up, what happens to flow? It goes down, right? They're inversely related to each other. All right, besides viscosity, what is there? There's a length of the blood vessel. As the length goes up, what happens to flow? It goes down because the resistance goes up. All right, so we got length. And the most important term, I know you guys are saving this to the very end. What's the most important term in Fuazui's equation? That determines resistance, which then determines a flow through a tube. By far the most important term, because it's the parameter that you multiply by itself once, by itself twice, and by itself three times. So you actually four times. What factor do you have to multiply by itself four times to determine the resistance? And it's the radius of a blood vessel. All right, so maybe I'll just kind of draw this on the board. Here we got any kind of vessel, could be any kind of tube or blood vessel. And the radius is what? The distance from the center of that tube to the edge. That's the radius right there. Okay. And what is this? This is the length of that blood vessel. So these things determine resistance to blood flow. All right, now what's going to be the force that's going to drive flow through this tube? Okay, it's going to be a pressure difference, right? Just like diffusion, things can diffuse from high concentration to low. How does a fluid move? From high pressure to low pressure. And if there's no pressure difference, then blood is not going to flow. So if we have pressure 1 over here and pressure 2 on this side, then if there is a change, we call that delta P. Right, so delta P is equal to P1 minus P2. And if there's a difference, blood is going to flow from one end of that blood vessel to the other. Okay. All right, so vasodilation decreases resistance and increases blood flow. All right, vasoconstriction, on the other hand, increases resistance and decreases blood flow. So here is an overriding equation that if you don't have an intuitive feel for, you just got to memorize it. All right, and here is the equation. It is flow is equal to delta P, right? As the delta P, as the difference in pressure increases, the flow is going to increase, so it's directly related, divided by the resistance to flow. All right, so you just got to somehow memorize that equation. That's just a very basic equation. And I think you should have an intuitive sense for that. Okay, and I'll leave that on the board. Okay, so here is some blood flow in milliliters per minute through various organs in our body. And we can see that our gastrointestinal tract and liver takes up almost 25% of blood flow. But that's because these are huge organs and the liver is very, very active. But now look at the kidneys. They're very small. A kidney is only about as big as your fist. Of course, you have two of them, but they require almost the same amount of blood flow as your total gastrointestinal tract. That's pretty amazing. So they're highly metabolic. So when blood flow to the kidneys is reduced, that's highly problematic, right? That causes a big problem. And the brain also. This is bigger than your kidneys, but it still requires a lot of blood flow. What's kind of surprising here is that your heart doesn't require a lot of blood flow compared as a percentage to your overall circulation. Okay. And muscles require a fair amount, but for instance, when you're not exercising a muscle, this blood flow is going to decrease quite a bit. Okay. All right, so blood flow through a vascular system, when there is a pressure difference, that's a delta P at two ends of a blood vessel, is equal to or is proportional to the difference in pressure from one end to the other. So here is a circulatory system. So this square box right here represents, what does this represent? What does that look like? That looks like the heart. Yeah? Uh-huh. Well, you know, the heart is not going to have to work as hard. So the cardiac output is going to go down. So the heart doesn't put out the same amount of blood every minute that you're alive. Right? So the heart's going to adjust itself to meet the demands of your body. So for instance, if you start exercising these muscles, and instead of 20% of blood flow, now maybe they require 50% of blood flow. What could you tell me about your heart rate and your respiratory rate? They're going to go up, right? So your cardiac output is going to go up. Your respiratory rate is going to go up to make sure that when that blood is circulating through the lungs that it picks up oxygen and gets rid of CO2. So your heart is going to compensate for that. Okay. Would any of these really go down? For instance, blood flow to the kidneys never goes down. Blood flow to the brain and heart never go down. But blood flow to skeletal muscles will go up and down depending on your metabolic activity of those muscles. And probably the same thing for the gastrointestinal tract. If you're in a fasted state, blood flow will go down. And when you're in a fed state, blood flow is going to go way up. So, and that's where some people get into problems, and that's why your mother always told you right after lunch when you asked her, could I go swimming? Please let me go swimming. And what would she always say? Nah, forget it. Okay, and the reason why is because right after lunch, right, your GI tract is receiving a lot of blood for digestion, and if all of a sudden you open up a bunch of vascular beds and skeletal muscle, there's not enough blood to go around and you're going to have cramps of some kind, muscle cramps or gastrointestinal cramps or something, right? Okay, so your body's going to try to meet the different demands. All right, so this is, what circulation did we say this was? That's the systemic circulation, right? Because it's coming from the left ventricle here. And the pressure at the left ventricle in the aorta, if it's normal, is 120 over 80. The mean pressure is 100 millimeters of mercury. So let's work with just the mean pressure in that systolic and diastolic. The pressure at the right atrium, on the other hand, is basically zero. So is there a pressure difference from left ventricle to right atrium? Yeah, and so blood is going to flow from the aorta into the right atrium because of that change in pressure, and the delta P, of course, is 100 millimeters of mercury. That's the driving force for moving blood through the total systemic circulation. Okay, so flow rate is also inversely proportional to resistance. So flow is directly related to pressure, that's the driving force, but it's inversely related to resistance. All right, so then we were talking a little bit about resistance. What are terms contribute to resistance? Well, it's the length of the blood vessel, right? So resistance is, maybe I'll just write it here. Resistance, R, is going to be proportional to the length of the blood vessel. Yeah, as the blood vessel length goes up, the resistance increases. Also, viscosity. What is that viscosity term? It's that little new number right there. And the diameter of the blood vessel doesn't increase resistance, it decreases resistance as it goes up. So it's inversely related to the radius. So we need to put a little radius term right here in the denominator, but this is a very special term because it's not just radius by itself, but it is what? It's radius times the radius times the radius times the radius, which otherwise is known as radius to the fourth power. Okay, so if the radius changes by a factor of 2, what can you tell me about resistance? What's the factor that resistance changes by? 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, right? 4, 8, 16. It changes by a factor of 16, which is a huge change. All right, so in our bodies, we don't really change the viscosity of our blood to regulate blood flow through various tissues. We don't change the length of blood vessels to regulate blood flow. The one parameter that our body can change to regulate blood flow by changing resistance is what, vasoconstriction or vasodilation, which is the radius of a blood vessel. And that's a very potent way of changing blood flow because it's according to the fourth power rule. Okay. So then if you stick resistance, right, this term into this blood flow equation right here, that gives you Poiseuille's equation, okay, which is what we have right here. So you should be familiar with this rule right here. So diameter of the blood vessel is very important for controlling resistance and thus blood flow in a blood vessel. That's Poiseuille's equation. Okay, so on this diagram right here, we see blood pressure versus various places in the cardiovascular system. And of course, from the last test, you know that the ventricular pressure goes from 0 to 120 millimeters of mercury in a normal individual. So this is a systolic, and then this is the diastolic pressure in the left ventricle. And then when the semilunar valve opens up, blood is ejected from the heart into the aorta. And again, blood in the aorta is pulsatile. As a matter of fact, all large arteries, it's pulsatile. And it deviates from systolic pressure to diastolic pressure, and then it flows through small arteries and arterioles. And we see a big pressure drop in arterioles right here. And even the pulsatile nature of blood changes. It gets dampened out. And so the mean pressure in arterioles is less than arteries, so you can see blood is flowing into arterioles. And what blood vessel has the lowest pressure? Okay, the veins do, right? Because we saw that on the previous slide. And what about capillaries? They're sort of low, but they're intermediate, right? So capillaries don't have the lowest pressure. A lot of students, when they first start taking a physiology class, well, say that capillaries have the lowest pressure because capillaries are a very significant part of the vascular system. Because of why? What happens in a capillary that can't happen in any other kind of blood vessel? Exchange. That's where exchange takes place, right? And you should know the anatomy of these different kinds of blood vessels. Why does exchange take place only in capillaries but no other kinds of blood vessels? Because they're really thin. All the other blood vessels are way too thick. They won't allow diffusion because they're thick. And even capillaries, because they're thin, some capillaries have spaces between the cells that even allow fluid to leak out of the cardiovascular system. Remember, there's three kinds of capillaries. There's the continuous kind, which is not very leaky. And then you have the fenestrated, which is sort of leaky. And then you have some that are really leaky, big spaces between them. And those are called the sinusoidal type of capillaries. All right, so it's a good thing capillaries don't have the lowest pressure, because what would happen if capillaries had the lowest pressure? Yeah, all the blood would flow into capillaries, even from veins. It would flow into a capillary, and it wouldn't get back to your heart as a result of that. And then your capillaries would get filled with blood and expand, and then they would just blow up, right? And there'd be blood all over the place. So it would be ugly. Okay. All right, so blood can be shunted from one organ to another by the degree of vasoconstriction of arterioles. So arterioles, we see the biggest pressure drop right here, which means that contributes pretty much the most to resistance in the circulatory system. And arterioles can vasoconstrict and vasodilate the most compared to any other kind of blood vessel. So this is where blood flow is regulated in your body, in arterioles. All right, so continuing to talk about capillaries, all right, so here we have a large artery like the aorta, and then some other large arteries, not quite as big as the aorta, then smaller arterioles, and then all the capillaries in our body, and then we see all these vessels and anastomoses to go back to the vena cava. If we look at the surface area versus these different blood vessels, all right, we can see that the cross-sectional area of the aorta is relatively small compared to the total cross-sectional area of capillaries. Now, capillaries are microscopic. They're very, very small in diameter, but if we were to add up all the millions and millions and millions of capillaries in your body and add the diameters together, it would be a huge diameter. It would be a large doorway. Okay? So that's what this diagram shows. So square centimeters is just what? That's just a surface. That's just a cross-sectional area. And the next graph over here shows the velocity of blood in terms of centimeters per second. So it's not blood flow. Blood flow is what? A volume per time. Velocity is just is a speed. It's just a distance per time. Like miles per hour, for instance, would be a velocity. Notice where you have the lowest velocity of blood. Is it in the aorta? Or do you have the lowest velocity in veins? The lowest velocity is, for instance, right here. And where is that? That's capillaries. All right, so there's an inverse relationship between the cross-sectional area of a tube and the velocity of blood flowing through that particular tube. All right, so the capillaries have the slowest velocity. So why do you think that's a good thing? And as a matter of fact, that is a good thing. Why do you think that's a good thing? Because what's happening in a capillary? Exchange. That's right. So if blood was moving fast through a capillary, there wouldn't be time for exchange. So it's really nice that the blood actually slows down when it gets into a capillary, and that allows for exchange to take place. And the reason why the velocity decreases so much is because there are just so many millions and millions of capillaries that the blood flows down. Okay, so I don't think this slide is in your textbook. Maybe I got it from your textbook, but I think I got it from a different one. Okay, so if you didn't download the slides, at least take a look at this one right here. Okay, all right, so, but this plot right here is not pressure. This is what? Velocity of the blood. Okay, different kind of thing. Okay, blood pressure. So arterioles play the most important role in blood distribution and control of blood pressure in our body. Blood flow to capillaries and blood pressure is controlled by the aperture or the diameter of arterioles, which is determined by the degree of vasoconstriction or vasodilation. Capillary blood pressure is decreased because they are downstream of these high-resistance arterioles. So here we have a tube, right, with some other tubes sticking out of it, and let's just pretend this is a nice plastic tube, not made of glass, and we can pinch it with this little thumb screw right here, right, and we can pour some fluid in to this reservoir, and the height of the fluid in this reservoir right here determines the pressure, right here. That's what you guys did in lab. You had a reservoir that you filled with water, and you tried to keep it constant even though water was draining out of it, so that meant that you had a constant pressure. All right, so this is the driving force for fluid out the ends of these tubes right here. All right, so this fluid is going to flow out of this tube, but if we put a constriction right here, all right, and we're going to decrease the flow, so would we decrease the flow by a little bit by putting a constriction here or a lot? You might say, well, it depends on how much you constrict it, but the point I'm trying to make is when you make a small change in the radius of this vessel right here, what happens to flow? A big change in flow, right? So even a small constriction is going to impede the flow of fluid through this constriction tremendously, all right? So very little amount of fluid is going to flow through here. So we see a big decrease in blood pressure in this, let's just call this an arteriole that's downstream of this constriction. Right, so it's not going to get very much blood flow because the pressure is decreasing. Right? Remember, flow is directly related to pressure, and if we constrict it, the pressure is going to drop and the flow is going to decrease. All right? Consequently, also, if we put a constriction here, that's going to increase pressure in this part of the tube, which means that it's going to force more fluid up these other branches. Right, so then if we release this constriction, this will get more flow, the pressure will drop here, and then these branches over here will get less flow. So your body can regulate flow by constricting various arterioles in your body. And it's being constantly adjusted all the time, depending on the metabolic demands of these tissues. All right, so capillary blood flow is also low because of the large total cross-sectional area. So here, again, we see that there's a huge cross-sectional area in capillaries, if we were to add all the capillaries up, and then we have a big decrease in blood pressure from one end of the capillary to the other as a result of that. It's not the lowest. The vena cava is still the lowest blood pressure. Okay. All right, so blood pressure is controlled mainly by these three parameters right here: heart rate, stroke volume, and resistance. Sometimes we call it peripheral resistance, sometimes we call it total peripheral resistance, or TPR. TPR is total peripheral resistance. So an increase in any one of these can result in an increase in blood pressure. All right, so let's work with a little bit of an equation right here. Okay, so what do we got? We've got, so delta P, another way of thinking of delta P is the blood pressure, the mean arterial blood pressure in your body, because we don't have to subtract it, because what's the blood pressure by the atrium, say the left atrium or the right atrium? It's zero. So if you have a number and you subtract zero from it, what do you got? You still got the same number, right? So we don't really have to be too concerned about the I'm going to drop the delta P because at the atrium it's zero. So let's say pressure over resistance is equal to what? What's pressure over resistance equal to? That's equal to flow. Okay? So here's flow. And how do we talk about flow? What is flow again? Is it centimeters per second or what? It's cubic centimeters per second or milliliters per, actually let's say milliliters per minute. Sorry, I led you astray just a little bit. So ml per minute, okay, that's flow. All right, but what did we look at in terms of milliliters per minute? There was a parameter of the heart that we measured in terms of milliliters per minute. What was that? That was cardiac output. All right, so I tell you what, let me move it up, I might run out of board. Cardiac output is flow, right? It's just milliliters per minute. And what was cardiac output equal to? Cardiac output, what's cardiac output equal to? You okay? You've got to have to become a little bit familiar with this. All right, cardiac output is equal to the amount of blood that your heart pumps out every time it contracts. What do we call the volume of blood that's pumped out of your heart every time it contracts? The stroke volume, all right, that's one thing. But we have to multiply this by what else? The heart rate. Yeah, stroke volume times heart rate. That's cardiac output. Okay. All right, so let me bring this down over here. Pressure divided by resistance is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. Now, that's probably not too intuitive for you, all right? I think cardiac output, you should be able to remember what cardiac output is and this flow relationship right here. And then we're just going to combine these equations. Now, I've got this resistance in the denominator over here. Let's get rid of this R term in the denominator and let's solve this equation just so that pressure is on one side. How can we get resistance out of this side of the equation? Okay, just move it on over to the other side, right? So if we multiply R by both sides of the equation, we've got R canceling the R over here on the left-hand side, and then what are you left with? You're left with pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times what? Resistance. Ran out of ink just a little bit, but do you see that equation? That's really important. So probably I'm going to underline it. Now what does that PowerPoint slide say? It says that pressure, okay, blood pressure is controlled mainly by heart rate, stroke volume, and resistance. And what did we just prove on the board right here? That's true. Okay, so that pressure is directly related to stroke volume. So if stroke volume goes up, what happens to pressure? It goes up as long as you hold everything else constant, right? If you hold stroke volume constant and resistance constant and you increase heart rate, what happens to pressure? It increases. All right, now here's the thing that's not intuitive at all, but it's really handy to see it in this equation. If we keep cardiac output the same, which is what, stroke volume times heart rate, if we keep cardiac output the same and increase resistance, what happens to pressure? You know what? I heard a wrong answer. Because pressure and resistance are directly related to each other. If resistance goes up, so does pressure. Okay? So you really got to see that. Okay? If resistance increases, then the pressure has to increase. Well, what happens if stroke volume and heart rate and resistance all go up? What happens? All right? Then pressure really goes up. All right? So, again, if resistance, what happens to pressure if resistance decreases? Then the pressure is going to decrease, okay? All right, so that's why I give you that equation, because I don't think it's really intuitive, but make sure you can derive that equation or at least memorize it so that you can come up with some answers, all right? All right, so sympathoadrenal activity raises blood pressure via arteriolar vasoconstriction. All right, so why is that so? Why does blood pressure increase when we vasoconstrict? Because vasoconstriction, okay, does what? It decreases the radius, which, and radius is inversely related to resistance, so when we decrease the radius, we tremendously increase the resistance in blood vessels. And when we increase resistance, what happens to pressure? It increases, right? Quite a bit, because the radius of a blood vessel determines the resistance in a big way. All right, sympathoadrenal activity also increases cardiac output, because there's a sympathetic outflow to both the, what does it say? Cardiac output, there's sympathetic outflow to both the sinoatrial node, right? And what's the effect of sympathetic nerves on the SA node? In terms of heart rate. I'm working with this equation right here. What's the sympathetic activity on the heart going to be? Yo! Got to look alive a little bit out there. Okay? What's the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the SA node? Is it going to be a chronotropic effect or inotropic effect? Okay, you know what? Close, but it's chronotropic. It's going to affect the heart rate. Okay, which way? Increase, decrease? Increase. It's going to increase heart rate, right? So sympathetic, increasing sympathetic tone increases heart rate. What's going to be the effect on blood pressure? It's going to increase blood pressure. But don't forget, sympathetic nerves also go to the ventricular myocardium. It goes to the ventricle muscles. They contract more forcefully. So guess what happens to stroke volume? It goes up. All right, so with sympathetic stimulation, resistance goes up, heart rate goes up, stroke volume goes up, which means your blood pressure is really going to go up as a result of that. Is that a question? No? Okay. You were just thinking. All right, so that's real important. The other thing that's real important is that the kidneys play a role in blood pressure by regulating blood volume. And, right, remember, because blood volume, if you increase blood volume, you increase venous return to the heart starts to stretch more, the stroke volume goes up. So if stroke volume goes up because you're increasing blood volume, that also increases blood pressure. Okay? Okay. And that's related to that most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure in the long term. What's the mechanism for regulating blood pressure in the long term? Okay. Write that question down and make sure you can answer that one. What's the most important mechanism for regulating? You guys make me wonder if I lectured last time or not. That's the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Did I talk about that last time? Yeah, I did. Okay. All right, I know it takes a while for this stuff to sink in, though. So renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. And that's the mechanism we can manipulate in somebody that has hypertension, for instance, in a number of different ways. And I think we talked about that last time. Okay, so that's blood pressure. All right, so as opposed to the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure in the long term, we're going to talk about how you regulate blood pressure in the short term, from second to second. Because, for instance, since you're sitting down listening to lecture, when you stand up after lecture, your blood pressure is going to drop. And the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism might take a day or something to regulate your blood pressure. All right, but if you stand up and your blood pressure drops, do you have a day to wait for it to come back to normal? No, because you might pass out, for instance, and you know you're going to miss dinner as a result of that. So there's got to be something else that regulates your blood pressure in the short term, second to second, and it's a neuronal reflex. It's not hormonal in nature, it's neuronal. So neuronal means what? Fast, short-acting, right? It's fast onset, short duration. Hormonal mechanisms are slow to take effect, but they're long-acting, right? So that's why the renin-angiotensin mechanism is for long-term, okay? And so it's you have to have a sensor someplace in your body to measure pressure. And these receptors are called baroreceptors. Right, so anytime you hear that term baro, what should you think about? What should kind of rise to your thinking? Pressure, right? If you ever listen to the weather report at night and you want to find out if it's going to be rainy or nice the next day, you can listen to the barometric pressure. And if it decreases, that means it's going to be rainy, like maybe this Saturday it might be rainy. But if the pressure is high, right, they call that the barometric pressure, right? They're just named after somebody that was starting to study pressure. Señor Barr was his name, okay? So we have baroreceptors, and They're located in the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinuses. So go ahead, show me where your carotid sinus is. Show me where your carotid sinus. Okay, you, where's your carotid sinus? Carotid sinus, that's nasal sinus right here. So that's close. Carotid sinus is at the bifurcation of the common carotid when it bifurcates into the internal and external carotid artery. All right, so it's in your neck right here. That's the carotid sinus. There's like a little bulb. And you can take people's blood pressure in the carotid artery because it's nice and superficial, but don't press on that bulb too much because you might pass out. And we'll tell you why that is in just a second. Okay? Okay, don't pass out. All right, so an increase in blood pressure causes the walls of these vessels to stretch. And so these basically are stretch receptors, but they're actually measuring pressure. As they stretch, there's an increase frequency of action potentials that are sent to the brain. As blood pressure decreases, the frequency of these action potentials decrease. Right? So that's the signal that your brain understands, right? It's just action potentials or the rate of action potentials. So as the stimulus increases, the frequency of action potentials increase. All right? The baral receptors send action potentials to the vasomotor center and the cardioregulatory center in the medulla. Medulla what? Medulla oblongata. I'm not talking medulla of the kidney. Kidneys, of course, are important for blood pressure, but in this particular case, the part of the brain stem. And the medulla is the integration center. So what does an integration center have? It's got a set point. It's got what your normal blood pressure should be. All right, so the vasomotor center and cardioregulatory center compare your blood pressure with what it should be, and then what does it do? It makes a decision on what it should do. And if the blood pressure is equal to the set point, what's the decision that the medulla oblongata makes? Just let things be because everything's perfect, right? But if there is a difference between your blood pressure and the set point, we call that an error, then the medulla's got to figure out what to do. If your blood pressure is low, the medulla is going to institute some reflexes that will bring your blood pressure back up. Or if your blood pressure is too high, it will institute some reflexes that will bring your blood pressure back down. All right, and the baroreceptors are most sensitive to decreases and sudden changes, right? So they're kind of like a phasic kind of receptor, not as much like a tonic receptor, right? So they're really looking for sudden changes, and in particular, decreases in blood pressure. All right, so here we have the anatomy of the baroreceptor reflex, pretty much most of it anyway. So here we got the heart, right? Here we got the ascending aorta and the arch, and on the arch we've got these stretch receptors that we call baroreceptors. And then here we have, what's this right here? What's the name of this vessel right here? What's the name of this one right here? Okay. That's what we call the brachiocephalic. All right, brachiocephalic coming out, that's the first branch off the aorta. And then the brachiocephalic bifurcates into the subclavian and then the common carotid. And then in your neck, the common carotid bifurcates into the internal and external carotid. And right in that bifurcation, there's a little bit of a bulge or an ampule, and we call that the carotid sinus, right? So sinuses can have all kinds of different things in them. It could have air, blood, depending on what. It's just the space in your body. And there are stretch receptors in the carotid sinus as well. All right, so these, please don't stimulate too much because I don't want you to pass out. But let's just say that this heart is operating normally and for some reason blood pressure increases. What happens to the carotid sinus right here when blood pressure increases? The pressure inside that artery increases. It's going to stretch and there's going to be an increase of action potentials, frequencies of action potentials. Going through this, and what do we call this in terms of a response loop? Okay, that's a hypoglossal nerve, if this is true. It is what, an afferent or efferent? That's an afferent neuron, so the afferent neuron is the hypoglossal nerve. Going into the medulla oblongata, so the medulla oblongata is the, in terms of a response loop, that's the integration center, and it's got the set point. It's going to compare your blood pressure with the set point, all right, then make a decision on what to do. And the decision can be one of two things. It can influence the parasympathetic nervous system or the sympathetic nervous system. And these are divisions of what? The autonomic nervous system, right? Okay. All right, so don't forget, the parasympathetic outflow is what kind of outflow? It's craniosacral, right? So it's going to leave a cranial nerve. Like what cranial nerve would be good to say? The vagus, yeah, number 10. But sympathetic outflow, is that craniosacral? Indeed not. It is thoracolumbar. All right, so if the medulla decides to send signals out through the sympathetic system, it has to leave the thoracic division. All right, so let's follow these signals out. Let's start with a stimulus. So let's just say that there is an error in blood pressure. What would you like the blood pressure to be, too high or too low? Too high, okay? Let's say it's too high for whatever reason. All right, so that high pressure signal comes to the medulla oblongata, and what does it want to do? It wants to bring your blood pressure back down. All right, so it's going to decrease signals out through the sympathetic nervous system, and it's going to increase signals out through the parasympathetic nervous system. And the parasympathetic nervous system can send signals only to the SA node and the AV node. It doesn't send any signals to the ventricular myocardium because there are no nerve fibers that go there. All right, so what's going to be the effect on the SA node and AV node? It's going to decrease the slope of those of the pacemaker potential of the nodal fibers of the SA node, so it takes longer to reach threshold, so the heart rate is going to decrease as a result of that. Okay? All right, so heart rate decreases when there's parasympathetic stimulation of the SA node and AV node right here. Now, what is the effect on blood pressure when that happens? Okay? Can you remember this equation right here? If you decrease heart rate, what happens to blood pressure? And you're going to hold stroke volume and resistance the same. Blood pressure is going to decrease as a result of that. All right, so that's really the only place where parasympathetic nerves go. Okay, it doesn't go to the ventricles, and it doesn't go to blood vessels. It can't change resistance in blood vessels. All right, now let's take the other. Also, if the result is a decrease in blood pressure, how does that feed back to the original stimulus? What was the original stimulus again? High blood pressure, all right, and the response is lowering blood pressure. So does that add to the stimulus or subtract from the stimulus? Subtract, so what kind of feedback loop is that? Negative, so that's going to maintain homeostasis as a result, okay? All right, so that's one end of the baroreceptor reflex. The other end is, let's just say there is a sudden drop in blood pressure. Like what's going to happen to you when you stand up after a lecture? A drop in blood pressure. There's going to be a decrease in action potentials sent through the hypoglossal and vagus nerve to the adrenal medulla, medulla oblongata. Sorry, adrenal medulla oblongata. The error is too low, so the medulla oblongata is going to say, we need to boost blood pressure. I need to decrease signals in the parasympathetic nerves, and I need to increase signals going through the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so where do sympathetic nerves go? Down into the thorax. They leave, right, the cell body. It's not an anatomy book, so you should probably be offended a little bit by some of the drawings right here, because where's the cell body for sympathetic nervous system? It's not in the ventral horn, it's in the lateral horn over here, if you can remember that. Okay, the lateral horn, but then it comes out, what is this thing here? That's the ventral root, because that's motor, right? The ventral root is always the motor root. Sympathetic nerve, now this is the preganglionic fiber, leaves the ventral root, and it goes into the sympathetic chain ganglia. But it doesn't enter here, it actually enters over here. Remember that this preganglionic fiber is myelinated, so it looks kind of white, so this is going to be the white ramus communicantes coming in. And here's the synapse, right? So here's a group of nerve cell bodies, this is the sympathetic chain ganglia. And then here's the postganglionic fiber, and where does this postganglionic fiber go? It goes to basically two places, nodal tissue in the atrium. It releases, what is a release? Oh, I should have asked you that for parasympathetic. But what does a sympathetic nervous system release on these nodal cells right here? Norepinephrine. Okay, and so that increases the slope of the pacemaker potential on these nodal fibers, so that increases the heart rate. All right, what happens to blood pressure as heart rate increases? It goes up because of this equation right here. All right, but there are also sympathetic fibers that go to the ventricle that increase the strength of contraction. What happens to blood pressure when the strength of contraction increases? Because stroke volume increases, blood pressure goes up. All right, and then there's a third fiber that actually goes to blood vessels that cause blood vessels to vasoconstrict. When norepinephrine is released on blood vessels, they vasoconstrict. What happens to resistance when blood vessels constrict? It increases, and then what happens to blood pressure as a result of that? It goes up too, remember, right over here? So under sympathetic stimulation, you have an increase in resistance, an increase in heart rate, and an increase in stroke volume that produces a large increase in blood pressure. All right, so that's one reason why you might get a little lightheaded when you stand up when you're sitting down, but this baroreceptor reflex is going to catch that decrease in blood pressure, and as soon as you stand up, I tell you what, you could measure your heart rate when you're sitting down and then stand up, and what are you going to notice? It's definitely going to be faster. Okay, as a result of that, that's what's going to maintain your blood pressure. Okay, so let's so norepinephrine is released. What about the neurotransmitter that's released by the parasympathetic nerves right here? It's going to be acetylcholine. All right, so there's a little bit of difference there. Okay, so what disease process is very prevalent when it comes to blood pressure? Hypertension, okay? And what did we say? What kind of mechanism is almost perfect in terms of regulating a certain parameter, like in your car? If you want to regulate the velocity of your car, what do you need? Yeah, you need some kind of antagonistic control. You need an accelerator and a brake pedal, right, in order for you to have nice, precise control and balance over your car. Now, what about blood pressure? It would be nice to have antagonistic control over blood pressure, but let's take a look at that. All right. So in terms of the parasympathetic nervous system, which one of these factors can it influence? Can it influence stroke volume? Can it influence heart rate? Can it influence resistance? You would say parasympathetic nervous system can't influence the inotropy of the heart, can't not influence stroke volume. Parasympathetic nervous system can influence heart rate, it can influence the chronotropy of the heart, but the parasympathetic nervous system can't affect resistance because it doesn't go to blood vessels. All right, so parasympathetic nervous system only on the heart. Now what about sympathetic nervous system? Can sympathetic nervous system affect the inotropy of the heart? Absolutely, because it goes to the ventricles. What about the chronotropy? Absolutely, because it goes to the nodal cells. And what about resistance? Sympathetic nervous system on resistance. Yes, it goes to blood vessels, causes vasoconstriction. Okay? So of these three important variables, stroke volume, heart rate, and resistance, which one is under antagonistic control in the autonomic nervous system? Only heart rate. Okay? The others are under tonic control by the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so if I was going to design control of blood pressure, I would probably design antagonistic control for all these three parameters. And because we don't have antagonistic control over stroke volume and resistance right here, that might be one simple explanation why hypertension is so prevalent, because, all right, what's the effect of sympathetic stimulation? It can only increase blood pressure. Resistance only increase blood pressure. All right. So that's maybe one way that you could think about controlling blood pressure, right? Okay. All right, so this is going to be an exam figure for you. This is just a flow diagram for the baroreceptor reflex. So make sure you know all the steps of a reflex or a response loop. What are the steps of a response loop? How does a response loop always start? It always starts with a? And it always ends with a response. Okay, so let's start with a stimulus. Okay, so you got stimulus. What's the next step in a response loop? I got a receptor, and the next component is the afferent neuron, okay, or afferent pathway, and then what? You got an integration center or integrator, and what does the integration center have? The set point, all right? The integration center makes a decision on what to do, depending if there's an error signal or not, and it sends the decision out. What? Where does it send the decision? The efferent pathway or neuron to an effector, and the effector produces a response, right? And if the response subtracts from the stimulus, that's nice negative feedback, maintaining homeostasis. But if it adds to the stimulus, that's positive feedback. And normally, positive feedback does not maintain homeostasis. It produces a disease state. But you learned some pretty interesting positive feedback mechanisms that are normal in this class. Could anybody give me one? Oh, contractions during childbirth. This is true. I don't know if we talked about that, but that'd be cool if I did. Okay, but in terms of blood clotting, there's a positive feedback mechanism. In that initial phase of depolarization of an action potential is a positive feedback mechanism. That's why it happens so fast. All right, well, let's get back to baroreceptor reflex. All right, so going from a reclined position to a standing position, all right, gravity is going to be pulling on blood, and it's going to be pulling blood to your extremities. So blood is kind of being pulled down to your extremities. It's not flowing back to your heart, so venous return decreases as a result. So what happens then to the heart when not as much blood is flowing back to it? Well, how much blood fills the heart then? A lower amount. So that end-diastolic volume decreases. And if end-diastolic volume decreases, what happens to stroke volume? It decreases. And what law of the heart tells you that? What law of the heart tells you that? That's the Frank-Starling law, right? Because it's just a length-tension relationship pertinent to the heart and the sarcomeres within the cardiac muscle cell. So when cardiac volume goes down, what happens to cardiac output? It decreases as well. And just make sure you keep your heart rate the same. All right, so cardiac output goes down. What happens to blood pressure? All right, so don't forget, cardiac output is what? Really stroke volume times heart rate. If that goes down, what happens to blood pressure? Yeah, it decreases. All right, so that's the initial stimulus, a decrease in blood pressure. All right, but fortunately, there's somebody there to monitor that, and those are the baroreceptors. Where are they located again? In the carotid sinus and the arch of the aorta. All right, and then they send signals through the medulla oblongata via the vagus nerve and hypoglossal nerve. All right, so then the medulla is going to then compare a decreased blood pressure with normal, and it's going to make a decision on what to do. So if blood pressure is low, what division of the autonomic nervous system is the medulla going to stimulate? The sympathetic nervous system, okay? So, and it's going to decrease activity on the parasympathetic nervous system. So the medulla causes vasoconstriction of arterioles, which does what? That increases resistance. And if we increase resistance, what happens to pressure? It goes back up, right? And that's the response. And how does it relate to the stimulus? Subtracts from, so it's a nice negative feedback loop, right? Okay, let's look at what else can happen. Sympathetic stimulation goes to the heart, and it increases heart rate because it goes to the nodal cells. That increases cardiac output, right? If your heart rate goes up, and then that causes blood pressure to go up. There actually should be a third line over here. Not only does it increase heart rate, but it increases stroke volume, right? Because it goes to the ventricle. And if stroke volume goes up, then of course cardiac output goes up. That increases blood pressure as well. Right, and that subtracts from the stimulus, and that maintains your blood pressure. Right, and then you don't pass out, so that's a really, really good thing. All right. So you should be able to work this reflex in the opposite way. For instance, if blood pressure increased all of a sudden, what would happen to your heart. Okay, so I mentioned a number of times, don't play around with your baroreceptors too much, right? Because if you palpate baroreceptors, you can actually stretch the wall of your carotid arteries, right? And what's going to be the response of those baroreceptors when you stretch them by poking around on them? It's going to increase the number of action potentials going to the medulla oblongata. So the medulla is going to think what's happening to your blood pressure if you stretch baroreceptors. The medulla thinks your blood pressure is skyrocketing, right? And the medulla is very concerned about blowing up blood vessels in various parts of your body. So what's the decision your medulla is going to make? Well, we better lower your blood pressure. It's going to cut back on sympathetic tone. It's going to increase parasympathetic tone. It's going to inhibit your heart rate, and it might slow your heart rate down so much that your blood pressure might drop and you might just pass out. As a matter of fact, I could probably do that to somebody in here if we could have a volunteer. Okay. Okay, just sort of kidding. I wouldn't want anybody to pass out. And I can't guarantee that what the length of duration of that inhibition on your heart would be, so I wouldn't even try. Okay, but if anybody's ever doing surgery on somebody's neck, then they got to be careful of those baroreceptors. All right, or maybe they got to put a little anesthetic on them, somehow poison them so that they are not operating when they're messing around with them, because if you manipulate them too much, you might even stop somebody's heart. All right, and of course that would be terrible when that happens. Okay, so what kind of mechanism is this? Is this good for long-term or short-term regulation of blood pressure? Short-term, right? So even when somebody has hypertension, this system is working just fine, right? Somebody with hypertension or hypotension, right? This system works pretty fine because long-term hypertension is due to what? The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, okay? Now, does anybody have any questions over this baroreceptor reflex? I usually have a couple of really good questions like, can you train yourself to have high blood pressure? And as a matter of fact, you can. For instance, athletes sometimes do if they don't have proper training, and especially for people that are weightlifters. Because one tendency weightlifters have when they're lifting something heavy, or anybody has when they're lifting something heavy, right? Like if I'm going to lift something heavy, what's the tendency that people have? Hold their breath, okay, and then lift something up, okay? So what happens to pressure in your thoracic cavity when you hold your breath and you compress your chest? What happens to pressure? Okay, it increases. As a matter of fact, if you pressurize your chest and open up your mouth real quick, you're just going to have a lot of air popping out of it, okay? Well, when you increase the pressure in your chest, guess what? That forces or that stops venous return to your heart, right? Because now it's high pressure in your chest. Blood can't return to the heart. So what happens to end diastolic volume when you're working really hard, pressurizing your chest? We call that a Valsalva maneuver. When you close your mouth, stop breathing, and pressurize your chest, that's a Valsalva maneuver. All right, so what happens to end diastolic volume when you're lifting this weight, doing that Valsalva maneuver? Blood can't get back to the heart, so end diastolic volume goes way, way down. So what happens to your blood pressure while you're doing that? Okay, it drops, right? And then you stop lifting weights and your blood pressure is really low. I almost want to finish that, but I'll get to your question, okay? So your blood pressure drops. It's measured by the baroreceptors, and what do the baroreceptors do? They say, oh my God, your blood pressure is dropping. We better do something really quick. Like what? Stimulate the sympathetic nervous system. Let's increase your stroke volume. Let's increase your heart rate. So your heart rate goes up, your stroke volume goes way up, and it also vasoconstricts blood vessels. Right? So now what happens to your blood pressure? It goes way up. And if you keep doing that time after time after time, this reflex right here just trains this whole system to maintain high blood pressure. Okay, so if you lift weights and you don't breathe, so when you lift weight, what should you do? Always exhale. You should always be breathing, right? And that protects you from developing high blood pressure, the training effect for high blood pressure. Yeah.
But for in the Olympics, they have people that do like illegal, or they add more blood to their...
Oh, okay.
Is that bad?
Yeah, that's kind of bad for your body. I don't think it works really well. You have to be careful how you do it because when you add more red blood cells to your body, the rationale for that is that what does a red blood cell do for you? It carries oxygen, right? So when you start exercising muscles, you need oxygen. Those mitochondria need oxygen. Well, let's put more oxygen-carrying cells in your body, like red blood cells, and maybe we'll get more oxygen to the tissues, and we can work harder because the mitochondria will make more ATP as a result. But when you put, so it's kind of a nice way of thinking, but what happens, they didn't study their physiology quite enough, all right? When you increase the hematocrit by putting all just, it's not blood that they're putting in, they're just putting in red blood cells. So they increase the hematocrit, they don't increase plasma. So now you put all these solid objects in your blood, guess what happens to the viscosity of blood? It sludges up. Okay, so what can you tell me about resistance when you sludge your blood up by enhancing your hematocrit? Resistance increases, so what happens to blood flow when resistance increases? Yeah, it goes down. So I think it's counterproductive to increase your hematocrit. Maybe you could boost it 1% or 2%, right? But if you go much more than that, you're going to be inhibiting blood flow to tissues. But the competitors are so highly trained, maybe that 1% or 2% change might just give somebody 1/10 of a second edge over somebody else, so maybe that's why they do it. But if they get carried away, then it, really hurts them. Okay, I would guess more people would really get carried away. I don't think they would be sophisticated enough to really know how much to be transfused. Okay, so that's what I think about red blood cell doping. Not really a good thing. Okay. Any other questions on these guys right here? Okay. So that's it for this particular chapter. So let's see what the next chapter is. I think it is 16. All right, I didn't enable this chapter just yet, so I'm just going to make some opening remarks and then we'll be able to take a break. All right. Okay, so respiration has a number of different components associated with it. All right, it is ventilation. Ventilation is just moving air in and out of your lungs. It's breathing, basically. All right, it's gas exchange. It's gas exchange at two places. It's gas exchange in the lungs, and there's gas exchange in the tissues. So what circulation provides for gas exchange in the lungs? That is the gas exchange in the lungs is the pulmonary circulation, all right? And what kind of blood vessel allows for exchange in the pulmonary circulation? I hear just a lot of mumbling. What kind of blood vessel allows for exchange?
Capillary.
That's what I was asking. Yeah, it's a capillary. Okay, it's a capillary because they're thin. All right, and then the other, and then tissues. What circulation allows for exchange in the tissues?
Capillary.
Okay, that's a kind of blood vessel. You got to have capillaries in that circulation. What circulation is that that's feeding the tissues? That is your systemic circulation, right? Okay, this is just kind of a review from anatomy. All right, and then of course we're concerned about O2 utilization, but we looked at that. We spent a couple of weeks looking at O2 utilization already, and that is cellular respiration. And what's the bottom line for cellular respiration? I mean, you're using oxygen, producing CO2, but bottom line, what's the whole purpose of cellular respiration? Is to make ATP, right? Okay, so that's an important function for ventilation. All right, so ventilation moves. I don't have my cursor enabled. Ventilation moves air in and out of the lungs for gas exchange. Sometimes we call this external respiration. All right, O2 utilization sometimes is what we refer to as internal respiration. And you're pretty much familiar with both of these. All right, gas exchange is passive process and it occurs only by diffusion. All right, so what does that mean? Which way does, for, and the gas we're interested, what are the two gases we're interested in? Oxygen is number one, we want that entering our bodies, and what's the other gas? Carbon dioxide. Oh, what produces carbon dioxide? A part of cellular respiration, but what part is cellular respiration? The Krebs cycle. Yeah, the Krebs cycle produces CO2. Okay, now those gases can only move by diffusion. So what does that mean? They can only move from high concentration to low. So if carbon dioxide is leaving your body, where is it high? It's high in your body, right? But fortunately, it's lower outside, so it leaves. As a matter of fact, carbon dioxide concentration in the air is almost zero. So there's a huge concentration gradient. So it's easy for us to get rid of carbon dioxide by breathing. Now, where is oxygen concentration high? In your body or in the air? It's in the air. That's right. So if it was lower in the air, it would never enter your body. Your body can only use diffusion for moving these materials around. Okay. Well, I think you're familiar with this kind of stuff already, right? The lower respiratory system starts at the larynx, and then air flows into the trachea, and then after this bifurcation, we see the primary bronchus, and then secondary, et cetera, tertiary bronchus, right? And these all have cartilage around them. Why do all these structures have cartilage around them? Okay, because sometimes when you're breathing rapidly, you compressurize your chest to force air out, compress your chest to force air out, and if these windpipes didn't have cartilage, when you compress your chest, the airways would compress as well, their diameter would decrease, and what would happen to flow? It would stop. Remember, that's really important law, Poiseuille's equation. All right, so these are held open all the time, even though you can pressurize your chest. They're open so air can leave your lungs. Okay, and then we get down finally to terminal bronchioles. They still have a little bit of cartilage, but then we get some respiratory bronchioles. And now these things don't have cartilage, and some of them have these little pockets on them. So this is the first place where exchange can actually take place. So there are capillaries associated with these little bulges right here. And then finally you get into these alveolar sacs. It's a group of alveoli, and this is where exchange takes place. Okay, and if we were to count the number of alveoli that we have in our bodies, we have about 300 million, which is a lot. Okay, what do I have on the next slide? Do I have anything? All right. Well, I want to talk a little bit about these alveoli. They have this shape because it maximizes exchange. So you could think of an alveolus as a little grape or maybe an apple or even an orange. And you can peel an orange. So you could take the peel of an orange and lay it down on the table flat. And what could you measure? You could measure the surface area of on the outside of that orange. So if we were to do that with all the alveoli, flatten them out, okay, not just squish them, all right, but lay them out on the table so that they're very, very flat. Add all 300 million together. What would be the size of that table? Okay, it would be huge. As a matter of fact, it would be about 70 square meters. And 70 square, I know you're going, wow, that's really big. So how big is 70 square meters? It's about the size of half of a tennis court. That's a huge surface area, okay? And when I say surface area, I want you to know in everyday language what that really means, okay? Surface area really means, maybe some of you have taken a class with me already, it means a doorway for exchange. So here we have a door, right? What's the surface area of this door right here? I don't know. Does anybody know? Anybody measure it lately? Okay, well, I got, let's pretend this is a yardstick. It's almost a yardstick. It's a meter stick. So this doorway is? How wide? Let's say one. Yeah, let's say a meter. Well, it's a meter, right, because it's a meter stick. 1 meter wide. And how many meters tall? It is one and exactly 2 meters tall. Okay? So what's the surface area of this door right here? It would be 1 times 2 meters. All right? So how many people can get through that doorway at one time? Yeah, 2, maybe 3, something like that. Okay? Now, that's a pedestrian door. Now, think about the door on your garage. Let's just pretend we all have a garage. And it's got a car door. How wide is the car door? Instead of 1 meter, it's probably, well, maybe 10 meters. Maybe it's, you know, really wide, and it's going to be taller, too, probably. It's going to be more than 2 meters. So what's the, I don't know what the surface area of a garage door is, but it's a lot more than that. So how many people can get through a garage door at one time? Oh, 30, 40 people maybe at one time, right? So think of that as exchange. Right? So as the surface area increases, what can you tell me about exchange? It increases quite a bit. All right? So that's the reason why the lungs have such a huge surface area. It's for exchange, and the surface area is not like a pedestrian door or the size of a garage door. It's the size of more like a tennis court. All right? Now, to fit that surface area in your body through evolution, it's been folded, it's been convoluted so that it fits inside your thoracic cavity. And I think that's really cool because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall as a tennis court. Okay, so it's nice that it all is folded in there. All right, so the shape of these alveoli is so that it makes the surface area small, right? But, I mean, it makes it large, but it still fits in a small space for exchange. Okay. All right, and if we look at an alveolus, microscopically, this is what we see right here. So what kind of epithelium is used for exchange? Now, what are the different kinds of epithelium? Remember, epithelium is one kind of tissue that you have in your body. What are some other tissues that you have? You've got epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue, all right? And as far as epithelium goes, what are the types of epithelium? It's classified by number of layers and by shape. This shape right here is squamous, right? So a squamous cell of the simple kind, which means one layer is specialized for exchange. So this is a simple squamous epithelium. An alveolus is made of a simple squamous epithelium that we see right here. We do have some other kinds of cells in there, like macrophages. That's a monocyte that's left the cardiovascular system, and it's wandering around in here, gobbling up dust particles and viruses, and even hopefully that swine flu virus that might be floating around, right? Okay, and killing it. So the alveolar cells are simple squamous. There's also a type 2 cell, alveolar cell, and this one secretes something on the inside of this alveolus, which I'll get to talk about next time. Okay, and then here we have a capillary, and the wall of a capillary is what kind of epithelium again? It's simple squamous because it's specialized for exchange. So material can move, or gases can move from air inside the alveolus into the blood fairly easily because this is what we call the respiratory membrane. All right, so the parts of the respiratory membrane are the wall of the capillary, a very thin interstitial space, and this interstitial space is kind of exaggerated a little bit in this illustration. It's really not quite so thick. And then the wall of the alveolus, which again is really thin because it's a simple squamous epithelium. And then there's one other layer that I'm going to talk about next time that's secreted by this cell right here. So the type 1 alveolar cell makes up the wall. The type 2 alveolar cell makes a secretion for the inside of an alveolus. And you should probably look that up and tell me what that is next time in case I forget. Okay? All right, so that's it for today. Now, I think, did I pass around the sign-in sheet? Good, I hope so. Okay, so who's got the sign-in sheet in case you need it? It's probably in the back of the room someplace.